Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. I'm sure you know the stereotype of the only child. They're selfish, they're lonely, neurotic, unhappy, unfriendly. While those are enduring perceptions, they're not true. Our guest, Lauren Sandler, is an only child who is raising an only child. After having anxiety about her parenting decision and dealing with other people's judgments, she decided to investigate where all that negativity was coming from and what the latest research says about single-child families. The result is her new book called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. We want to hear from you. If you are one or have one, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Lauren Sandler has written for a number of publications, and she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. So nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's lovely to be here.
I struggled with those two words, only child, because even those two words seem so loaded.
You know, it's funny, there's a researcher at Harvard who writes about only children, and she will not use the term in her writing because she thinks it's a derogatory term. She writes singleton instead.
Does that make sense to you? Does it feel less freighted, less loaded?
I guess. I mean, singleton is a weird word, though. It means a lot of different things, but it is interesting that only child does seem to have so much bias and judgment behind it.
You write about a guy named Granville Stanley Hall. I don't know if we can blame him entirely for all the negativity about single children or only children, but he wrote something called Of Peculiar and Exceptional Children, writing about only children. What was his take?
So Stanley Hall was sort of the father of the child studies movement and one of the original major popular psychologists in America. And he was also from a large family in rural Massachusetts, and he loved his large family. And he didn't really have methods for child study yet. They hadn't exactly been developed, but that didn't stop him from going out and lecturing that being an only child, as he put it, was a disease in itself.
And but that theory, those beliefs took hold. Why do you think that is?
Well, I have puzzled over the origins of this stereotype and their lasting nature for a few years now. And I see about three things happening. One was, in terms of our evolution as a species, we needed to have more children because that's how we would survive. And then as we evolved into an agrarian set of people, we needed more children because they were a labor force. That's how we would farm the land. That's the only way we could thrive. The more children, the better. But then the Industrial Revolution came along and everything changed. Children were suddenly expensive instead of earning. And women changed. Women's role was evolving very, very quickly, and it was something that people had a lot of anxiety about, some people, including Granville Stanley Hall. Mm-hmm. And I think that in order to keep telling the story that you need to mother more and more and more, that kept women's roles exactly where they were. And now we are pushing beyond that, but still really caught in this conflict of what it means to be a mother and also more than a mother.
Let me ask you a little bit about your parents, and as you write about them, and not in great detail, but they, and you're an only child, they seem to be very happy with that decision. It was a very conscious decision on their part.
It was a conscious decision. I grew up in a pretty small apartment in the Boston area, and we loved living in this apartment. And my mother did work that meant a lot to her, and she loved doing that work. And you know, they really thought quite hard about how it would change their lives, what it would mean to have to move into a house and be house poor, what it would mean to deal with all the opportunity costs within my mother's career, and also what it would mean just in terms of their own freedom. We got to have a lot of spontaneity and fun. It was pretty great.
And yet it's interesting that when you became a mom, you began to have some sort of doubts or some degree of anxiety about wanting just one child.
Well, as an only child, you know that it can be a double-edged sword of an experience. So a lot of it is truly wonderful. And then there are some aspects of it that can be complicated. I think that it's further complicated by the bias and further complicated by the fact that our conversation about raising only children begins and ends with don't do it. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about things to be mindful of as parents of only children. And so because of that, it can be an isolating experience as a parent. And, you know, all the people who I was friendly with had their first kids, and then they went on and had their second kids. And you think about it. You think about all of these terrific parents around you and friends who are making other choices. You think about how those choices feel to your own child. And it's something that I think all of us think about.
You have described, you know, being in a supermarket or strangers, in a sense, commenting on your child and then asking, you know, where's the other one or when is the other one coming, as a kind of expectation that parents or moms are going to have more than one child.
Always. I, you know, saw the pharmacist from my local drugstore on my block 2 days ago, and she said, so when are you having the next one? She didn't even say hello to me.
She knows you that well, right?
I guess. And it's funny. Usually what happens, and I've had this encounter many times, and I've heard from many parents of only children who have had it too, that you have that lovely moment with a stranger fawning over your adorable kid, and then they ask if you're having another one or when, and you say you're not planning on it, and everything freezes.
Really?
And suddenly, I've heard the sentence, you wouldn't do that to your child, from complete strangers, more than I could possibly tell you. Luckily, I don't hear it from my family or friends, but that's where other people get pressure too.
Which is turning your only child into a selfish, lonely, neurotic, unhappy, unfriendly person?
Exactly. I am clearly, automatically screwing up my child by not giving her a sibling. And I must be doubly selfish, right? Because I'm an only child with an only child. What could be worse?
And you think women feel that or accused of that being selfish more than men, for instance?
Yes. I have met almost no men. I don't know if I've actually interviewed a single man who has had that bias leveled against him. It is really something that mothers hear. Even though, you know, my husband and I co-parent really effectively. He's as much of a parent and caregiver and domestic partner within the family as I am. And yet he never would hear a word about any of this.
As you mentioned, being an only child can be a double-edged sword. And I have to say, I have one child. It was not my intention, but that's what I ended up with. And I know there are times when he was growing up when he would have loved to have siblings just so he could, you know, complain frankly about his parents. And there were times when it was just him against us. And I think in many ways it was a really unfair fight.
It is. It's funny, especially during adolescence, I think it's really hard. I actually learned recently that I am not alone in nicknaming my parents the United Front. In fact, the day after my book came out, my parents greeted me for breakfast wearing T-shirts that said the United Front on them. It was hilarious. But it does feel like that you are inherently outnumbered if you have two parents. And even if you have one, you have one parent with power. And you don't have a lot of power. And that's hard. I, however, found that having close friends made all the difference to me. And I have friends from my adolescence who are still like siblings to me and still talk about my parents as though we are siblings together. And so I do think that you end up with chosen family in a very intentional and special way. It's not the same, but it does counteract things a little bit to feel like you have allies in the world.
And I wonder how common that is, because I have to say that my son has always had very intense and loving and deep relationship, friendships, frankly, with people in his life.
It's very common. We do tend to nurture friendships as though they are family relationships. And part of that is because, you know, when you have a sibling, if you're terrible to your sibling all day, you still have to sit down for dinner with them. They're not going to disappear, at least not for a while, if they do. With friends, you really do have to nurture those relationships and be intentional about them. And I think that it actually makes us very good friends.
You looked at a lot of the research about single children or only children and looked at this notion of selfishness. And mm-hmm. that seems to be the tag that is followed only kids. Is there any truth to that, that single children are any more selfish than other children?
Within the data, there is no truth. And so in terms of the stereotype of only children being lonely and selfish and maladjusted, there have been hundreds and hundreds of studies over decades that disprove this idea. Selfishness, though, within the lived experience, yeah. I found it an issue to wrestle with. I wrestled with it philosophically. What does selfishness mean? You know, I went to philosophy for it. I dusted off my Ayn Rand to sort of see what she would have to say, and then I put it back on the bookshelf. But it's funny. For some people, it's a question of narcissism. And so every few years, they dust off the narcissism index and run only children and kids with siblings through it to test the hypothesis that only children are more narcissistic. And every time, they find out yet again that it's not true. Or there's the question about sharing and generosity. And all studies of only children show that only children share just fine. And in fact, this notion of friendships as being something to be won and preserved more actively actually encourages kids to be more generous sometimes. The question of spoiling comes up as a part of this, but to me, that's just a question of mindful parenting. Mm-hmm. So you can spoil a bunch of kids or you can spoil one kid. And that's really something which is on the parents, I think, and not an inherent condition of an only child.
Because clearly with, let's say, parents or even a parent of an only or single child, that child is the focus of so much attention.
It's true. And you have to know to pull that focus back. And that can be tough to do. It takes a lot of awareness.
To sort of see one's effect on one's child and
yes.
probably trying to understand the position that it puts them in.
Sure. I mean, a one-child family has less diversity than other families. There's less competition for attention. And then there are also fewer personality types that are buzzing in the air. And so that does change the dynamic. But it's interesting. The only places in which only children tend to differ in the research from kids with siblings are in terms of intelligence, self-esteem, and achievement motivation. And the way to understand those higher scores in those regards is because of that undiluted attention and energy that all of those resources put into one kid can be really good for them.
Is there some parallel then between only children and firstborn children?
Yes, they are often considered very much in the same way, kids with leadership qualities, kids who do better on IQ tests. But one thing which is different, I interviewed a man named Frank Soloway who wrote a book that I found very interesting called Born to Rebel that looks at scientific innovation and birth order. And his book basically showed that all radical innovation tends to come from youngest borns. And I said, okay, so if only children tend to be grouped with oldest borns in terms of achievement and intelligence, does this mean that we're not radical innovators? And he said, no, you're wild cards. You're ones with those assets, but then you tend to get to determine your own path in a more active way. So you can turn out to be anything. It's much harder to tell, which proved that it's really hard to put us in
sure.
a box. And I think that that's what people tend to do. But there's no such thing as one only child or one only child experience.
What, and you can be both the first and the last born, right?
Well, exactly. That's the whole idea. You're both oldest and youngest at the same time.
Did you, though, go through a period of wanting siblings?
I didn't as a kid. I thought about it occasionally as an adolescent. You know, in my mid to late 30s, it also occurs to me sometimes. But I've never wanted it enough to really want it. I've been curious about it, you know, and there are moments in which I've thought, man, I really wish I could get someone else into this conversation.
Sure.
But honestly, my close friends and my husband have done a great job playing that role. Not that I have a sisterly, brotherly marriage in any sense, but he's been around for a while and he's a big support and family's family.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also, I do want to open the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And again, Lauren Sandler is our guest today on the show. And she's got a brand new book called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. And frankly, that's what we're talking about. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Lodge Lane Assisted Living supports WHYY. Lodge Lane is now accepting reservations for their new facility located near Wilmington, Delaware. Guided by time-honored Jewish traditions and values, Lodge Lane welcomes residents of all faiths in a supportive, friendly environment with round-the-clock staffing to assist with daily tasks. Featuring a variety of floor plans and amenities that include kosher and non-kosher dining and a secure memory wing. More at 302-764-7000 or lodgelane.org.
Starting Monday, there's a new show on WHYY. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway. We're a fast-paced look at the news of the day where you can expect to hear a broad range of conversations, top guests, and when it comes to the news, we look at the facts, but we ask questions to push as hard as we can to challenge what we believe to be true, seeking a deeper understanding. It's all part of the conversation, all part of your conversation, we hope. The Takeaway, join us Tuesday through Friday at noon here on WHYY.
Are ivy-covered walls sure to tumble before their time? Or could the plants actually be protective? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll look at the pros and cons of ivy-covered buildings. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking about only children, single children, one-child families. And again, our guest is Lauren Sandler, author of a new book called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Lauren, I'd love to have you read just a section from your book there.
Sure. Here's some things I want. I want to do meaningful work. I want to travel. I want to eat in restaurants and drink in bars. I want to go to movies and concerts. I want to read novels. I want to marinate in solitude. I want to have friendships that regularly sustain and exhilarate me. I want a romantic relationship that involves daily communication beyond interrogatives and imperatives. I want to be known. And I want to snuggle with my daughter for as long as she'll let me, being as present in her life as I can while giving her all the space she needs to discover life on her own terms. I want full participation in the world, in my family, in my friendships, and in my own actualization. In other words, to have a happy kid, I figure I need to be a happy mother. And to be a happy mother, I need to be a happy person. Like my mother, I feel that I need to make choices within the limits of reality, which means considering work, finances, pleasure. And at the moment, I can't imagine how I could possibly do that with another kid.
And that's, I mean, in a sense, that's the heart of your story and also the heart of this book, which is that this is what you wanted. And you wanted it for all the reasons that you just laid out there.
It's true. Though, you know, it's interesting, the question of choice, I think, can be a little complicated, in part because I think one of the main reasons that we have such a growing number of only children is delayed fertility. This is why there are fewer children in the U.S. in general right now, why our families keep getting smaller, is because we put off having kids. Because we're looking for the right romantic partner, because we want our work lives to be in the right place, which we all know they never will be, but we say it's not the right time. And it often isn't the right time for legitimate reasons. And then it's funny because you get to the point where your body says, okay, it's going to be one and done for you. Mm. And then it doesn't feel like a choice. And I think it would be so good for people to own the power of those choices, to say, yeah, I did wait. And I waited to have these things in my life that would make me happy so I could be a good parent. And now I have a kid that I love. And let's do this, instead of feeling the pain of not being able to have a bigger family. Because I do think it is so hard to not have a second kid when you really want one. But I do wonder if we felt more empowered by the things that often lead us there, and also if we could dial down the bias and judgment, if that pain would be quite so acute.
There are a number of ways to end up with one child. One is choice, as you just said, but also there are some people, and I would include myself, that wanted more children. It just didn't happen for a whole host of reasons that I won't go in over the air. And some people get divorced and you end up with one child. So that there are reasons for single children. Some of them are less joyous and satisfying, I think, than others.
It's true. Life is complicated and unexpected. But we all know that, and yet we continue to put this pressure on parents to have more kids. We continue to say, if you don't have more kids, you're a bad parent. Your kid is going to turn out rotten. And that really doesn't help. It's interesting. There was a study done that shows that kids who are happy as only children tend to have mothers who seem empowered and happy with having just one kid. So if you're the sort of parent who will say, I really wanted it, I tried, it couldn't happen, I wanted it for you, that kid is going to be pretty unhappy as an only child. But if it feels like, listen, you're the one we love, you're the one we've got, this is our family, and it looks just like what we want it to look like, that then feels like a really strong choice, and that tends to be a lot better for kids.
And how much do you think birth control plays into this? You mentioned the fact that people are marrying later and having children later, and that sometimes limits how many children they want to have. But what about birth control? How has that changed the configuration?
Oh, I mean, this is all about family planning. And frankly, birth control, and also what it means to terminate a pregnancy if it's one that you don't want, which is something that's really tough to talk about.
Sure.
But it is interesting to remember that the majority of people who get abortions are actually mothers. And so the notion that you would never make that choice after having a kid is totally felonious. I was not able to get data on abortions after one child, which is something I really tried to find. And I interviewed a number of women at clinics to get anecdotal information, but I have yet to be able to figure out how common it is to, as I say, choose to have one kid when you're pregnant with another. But yes, I mean, this is what family planning is all about, planning your family.
Well, and it's interesting to talk about this when the economy has not done well and certainly affected some families more than others. I think in the Depression, you know, the birth rate went down. And it is interesting to just see how economics can affect some of these decisions, maybe in overt ways or more covert ways.
Total fertility always goes down when the economy tanks.
This is
something we've seen all over the world, all throughout history. And especially in America right now, when the cost of child rearing so outpaces regular inflation. So at the moment, a child who's born in 2011 will cost an average of over $250,000 to raise. And that includes kids born under poverty. So if your family makes a salary between all earning members of $100,000 a year, you're going to take about $400,000 to raise your kid just up until college, not even including saving for college. Kids are our biggest expense. And this is something that I think people feel really acutely. However, saying simply that, okay, we have fewer kids right now because kids are expensive and the economy is lousy, I think that tends to ignore a larger cultural shift which is happening, which is that women want to do more. They want, you know, either they need to work more. I mean, we have the recent study that 4 out of 10 women mothers right now are breadwinners.
Exactly.
And also, I think women want to participate in the marketplace. Women want to have independence. Women want to have power. And even though we talk about a work-life balance, that conversation tends to just be about a work-mothering balance, not a life outside of those two things. And I know that when I had a kid, I didn't stop wanting to go to concerts and read novels. I didn't stop wanting to hang out with my friends. I mean, we still want to have a life beyond the workplace and our domestic duties, even if we really enjoy both of those things. And I think that that's another thing that we need to take into consideration, too, is what we want a liberated adulthood that involves parenting to look like.
Well, that's exactly what your reading was about, which is that you do want to go to the movies and you do want to go out to dinner and, you know, trying to have all that and also to be a mom as well.
And apparently that makes me a selfish person. And if that's the case, you know, I will preach the church of maternal selfishness because I think it's something that we have lost. Everything now is about self-sacrifice. Never, you know, never baking enough organic cookies for the bake sale or never having your kid in enough soccer and ballet and Spanish classes to, you know, or Mandarin to keep your kid, you know, within the middle class right now. It's not just even a question of how the elite parents, this has trickled down throughout the entire American middle class, this notion of everything being about kids. It's interesting. There's a study in Italy about how parents raise their kids differently. And in this study, it was a time use study. You know, parents take their kids out to dinner and over to friends' houses. They hang out with other people. In the U.S., it's all about family time. It's about isolating the family from other people. And in this study, it said there is no such thing as the phrase family time in Italy. You can Google it. You won't find it.
Wow.
It is an American concept that we cocoon ourselves from other people because that's what we think parenting involves. And I think that that is something that having more kids in this country kind of pushes you to do a bit more. And it's not something that I think would be good for me or my kid, even though I do think that it's how a lot of people want to live. And I respect that.
Well, I think in some ways your book is tapped into that enduring parental or even maternal anxiety about, am I doing this right? Am I, you know, do I have the right number of children or am I taking them to enough classes?
Right. And it's interesting. One of the figures that stuck with me most in my research was that most people say that they have their first child for themselves, and they have their second child for the benefit of their first child. And I wonder what would happen if we had different information out there about who only children really were, if we would still feel like those second kids were as necessary. Because I know plenty of people who want them desperately and have that desire, and I think that's great. My concern is for people who don't have that desire and still think that it's really necessary.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Lauren Sandler, our guest today on Radio Times. She's a journalist. She's written for a number of publications, and she's the author of a new book, which has intrigued us. That's why we invited her on the show. It's called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. And we're getting some of our phone lines set up at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You had mentioned your parents, and I'm curious about their response to this book. And it's not a memoir, but you tap into some of their thoughts. In fact, begin with all of you sort of chewing the fat about your parental decisions.
It's true. You know, it's funny, the first line of the book is, "This is not a memoir."
And yeah,
my
exactly.
parents said, "What do you mean it's not a memoir? You're all over this book." You know, it's funny, as a journalist, I'm always interested in writing about things very far from me. You know, I reported in Iraq on women living under Sharia. My first book was on, you know, was written from a secular feminist perspective on the young Christian right. I tend to not want to hold up the mirror to myself. And
yeah.
So writing a book that considered my own choices and my parents' own choices, it was trepidatious at times. And it was interesting because most of us are, at least people I know, don't tend to really actively investigate their family's choices quite so much. So when I sat down with my parents and learned that it was actually something my father was quite ambivalent about, that he did have some longing for another kid, he wanted to know what it would be like to have a second child, that was a real eye-opener for me. And I do think that in most couples, it's unusual to have two people who want the exact same thing. And I've gotten a ton of mail from readers in the past couple weeks who have said, "I don't want to have more kids.
Huh.
My partner does.
Huh.
What do we do about this? How do we think about this and talk about this?" That wasn't the extreme within my parents' decision. You know, my dad was very happy with where we ended up. And it was something that I think my mother protected, knowing herself, for good reason. You know, my husband and I tend to be pretty like-minded about this. If I wanted another one, he'd go with it.
Right.
But, you know, he wanted that first one, and I went with that. So, you know, I think that it can be a tough debate within a marriage.
Let me see what that looks like. Ellen has to say. Ellen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
This is a very interesting topic for me as an only child. And I agree with the author. I had a wonderful experience as a child. My parents were very devoted. I had lots of friends. However, my parents had me late in life at the age of 41 and 50. And what happens then is you have elder care responsibilities much earlier in life, without any assistance, any feedback from siblings. And during my 30s, I had tremendous responsibility with an aging and very ill mother. My father died when I was in my 20s. He was in his 70s. So then by the age of 40, both parents are gone. I'm now in my early 50s. And it is not fun to be an only adult. It's wonderful and can be wonderful to be an only child, depending obviously on one's parents. But I have quite a few friends who are only children, and now as adults, they kind of echo the same sentiment.
That's interesting. Well, Ellen, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you want to weigh in on
yes,
that?
Yes, I'm so glad that Ellen brought this up. This is what I call the Greek tragedy of only childhood. And it's something that I think about all the time. My parents are very robust in their late 60s. It's nothing that we have to worry about yet, but I did see what they went through with their own parents. And they're pragmatists, so their response is to get long-term health insurance, which I appreciate. But that, you know, frankly, doesn't plug the existential hole in my heart. And so, you know, it's interesting. Most only children I've spoken to, whether we have older parents or not, we think about this all the time. And And elder care is a real issue. The data shows us that even if you have siblings, it tends to be the closest residing sibling who does it all. Or if the whole family lives in the same place, the eldest daughter who does it all. And I'm sure I should feel reassured by that. But that's one of those bits of information that just sort of glosses over something much deeper to me. You know, and I also know that there are plenty of families that have siblings that have incredible conflict around their parents' elder care. And that can be very difficult. However, yeah, this is a tough issue.
Sure,
and in
sure.
fact, a lot of people I've interviewed who chose to have a second child after deep ambivalence said that this really had a lot to do with it, that visceral feeling that I can't do this to my kid. And I get that. To me, it becomes a question of, is this reason enough to bring another life into the world? And for me right now, it doesn't feel that way, but I do understand to other people how it can.
And it is such an existential issue for children with aging parents. And as you said, sometimes in with siblings, that doesn't necessarily solve the problems that an only child might feel about an aging parent. And I sometimes wonder whether we romanticize siblings as well.
I think we do. I mean, psychologists tend to say that we idealize siblings as companions when what we actually get out of them is conflict, both, you know, not just because conflict is tough, but also that's how we develop. That tends to be the advantage to siblings. But, you know, there are siblings who are really wonderful friends to each other.
Sure.
There's just no
sure.
way to guarantee it. And families can be very complicated.
Ellen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Alex from South Philadelphia has to say. Alex, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Alex? That would be number one. We're having a little phone problem here. Go ahead, Alex. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to give a ring and say I've been an only child for 26 years and never really thought too much about it until my mother was my primary caregiver in my youth, passed away this past year. And I realized that I'm really jealous of people with siblings because they have siblings to help remember their childhood. And when you lose a parent as an only child, I'm never quite sure if I'm remembering my childhood correctly or, you know, really, really, yeah, what's to it. So
this is what
very poignant, yeah, very poignant issue, Alex. Yeah, go ahead, Lauren.
A friend of mine calls them blood-related fact checkers, and she's someone who lost both of her parents when she was quite young. And yeah, it's true. We don't have blood-related fact checkers. I feel lucky that I've had friends for a very long time who seem to be a version of that. I can call them up and in mid-sentence pick up in the middle of a conversation about my parents that began when I was 14 and it makes sense to them. But it's true. It's not the same thing, and I really get that jealousy.
Alex, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Reading your book, though, I was also thinking about our family policies. I won't say friendly policies because they're not particularly friendly in this country when you look at other countries like France, but how difficult we make it having children in this country anyway.
There's one researcher on parental happiness who, and I will paraphrase here, said to me, we tell you to do it more than anyone else, we tell you to love it more than anyone else, and we'll give you less help than anyone else. And it's true, in ranking family policy globally, it's not just Europe that tops the U.S. The U.S. actually vies between third and fourth place as the worst country in the world. We are bested by Suriname and Liberia. We have the same family policy as Swaziland. Mm. So this isn't just a question of, you know, the EU's got it worked out and we're backwards. It's not that old conversation. It's that, you know, what we once called the third world offers significantly more help than we do here. It means that we have no paid parental leave. It means that we have no state-sponsored child care. We don't have health care for our kids. I mean, it's a mess. It's a mess. And it's a mess that doesn't seem to be going anywhere because we're not even having a national conversation about it right now.
Well, we're having a conversation with Lauren Sandler, our guest today on Radio Times, author of One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Studio in Caminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City.
On the next Fresh Air, how being African in America compares with being African-American, we talk with Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie about her new semi-autobiographical novel, Americana. Growing up in Nigeria, she wasn't defined by her race. When she came to America to attend college, she found herself in the middle of racial conflicts she didn't even understand. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, the fallout from the landmark Supreme Court decisions. Also, a math whiz rethinks basketball's basic positions to include roles like a three-point specialist and a jump-shooting ball handler. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Studio Incaminati, School for Contemporary Realist Art in Center City, supports WHYY and celebrates its 10th anniversary with an artist's exhibition opening Friday, June 28th. The exhibition, on view through July 2nd at Freeman's Auctioneers and Appraisers, 1808 Chestnut Street, features over 100 works of art from instructors, students, and alumni, including some of the world's leading realist artists. During the exhibition run, founder Nelson Shanks will present a painting demonstration. Details at studioincaminati.org/freemans.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with journalist Lauren Sandler, who is an only child with an only child. And that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get James from Germantown to join us on Radio Times. And James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you this morning?
Good. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm an only child, and I have an only child with my wife. I was just calling to comment to let you guys know I am the guy who gets the, so when's the next one coming?
James, I've been looking for you for 3 years now. I found you
here in German, our very own Germantown.
And I get the sinking when I say didn't plan on any more. They're like, you're really going to do that to your little girl? And I was like, I didn't know I was doing anything to her.
And hopefully you don't think like you're doing anything to her, do you, James?
I'm going to tell you, when it happens enough, you start to look at yourself and say, well, am I doing something to her? But I've just learned to just say, hey, you know, she's been blessed with a big family, and she's very outgoing, so I know she's going to have friends. And, you know, it's just the decision that we made. My parents made the decision. You know, it's just, personally, it was just the decision I made. Now, my wife, when we first got married, she was telling me, oh, we're going to have 3 and 4 kids. But then after we got married and we started looking at life, and we had our one child, and she was like, that was enough. I used to tease her and say, remember when you wanted to have 3 and 4 kids? And she goes, I said that? I said, yeah.
Yeah. James, thanks so much for calling into Radio Times. I mean, he sounds like the male version of,
yeah,
of what
I relate. I relate. But he also raises an interesting point about how our choices are so sequential. And so when demographers study intentions, when they look at how many people want to have only children, they say nobody wants to have an only child. But when you ask an 18-year-old woman, what do you imagine your life looking like? She imagines more kids, because she is not imagining the money, the time, the energy, the competing factors in life. And part of this is about, as we grow older and we make choice after choice and we see how things feel to live with, our intentions change. And I think that this is one of those examples.
James, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I do want to get back to our callers, but you really got into a bit of a tussle with a piece that you wrote in The Atlantic. And here's the headline: The Secret to Being Both a Successful Writer and a Mother, : Have Just One Kid. Now, the headline kind of distorts what you wrote in the article, but nonetheless, a lot of women writers, Zadie Smith being one of them, push back really hard on you.
It's true. And what's sad is I never even knew about that title until I went onto the website and saw my article.
And you went,
Yeah, I thought, oh, this is not
good.
Here it comes. I mean, it's funny. I'm not someone who's afraid of a little controversy. I know that the things that I tend to believe can set people off. However, that headline isn't something that I believe, and that's what was so frustrating to me. So when I was researching my book, I noticed that four women writers I really admire, all of whom were journalists. Mary McCarthy, Elizabeth Hardwick, Joan Didion, and Susan Sontag all had one child. And I thought to myself, I wonder how their lives and their writing would be different if they had more. So I wrote this very sort of nerdy, narrow essay for The Atlantic about it. And then they slapped this headline on, and before I knew it, I had Jane Smiley saying, listen, I wrote 23 books and won a Pulitzer, and I have three kids and two stepkids, you know, coming into the comments and telling me that I was dead wrong about this. And I think that that's great that Jane Smiley got to do that.
Sure.
She got to do that with a lot of help from her local university with childcare and a lot of book advances that most writers don't ever get to see. Zadie Smith came in and said, Dickens and Tolstoy had 10 kids. And I'm thinking, how many meals do you think Tolstoy prepared and how many sippy cups do you think Dickens was washing back then? And, you know, Zadie Smith has a baby in addition to an older child. And I don't know what her experience is like. I do know that most women who write either have no kids or two or more kids. And so clearly you can write with more kids and you can be creative with more or none. But this is a choice, you know, or a circumstance of being a writer with one child, which is something which is so vilified in the public to have just one child, that it was a way to say, let's consider the richness of a life with just one.
Well, what I found so interesting, we could do a whole show about it, was just, and it seems it's a kind of a deja vu all over again, which is a woman writes something about her life and choosing either work, family, or some version of that and children. And frankly, women pounce.
They pounce. Yeah, the New Yorker wrote me up as being divisive. The Guardian ran, I think, two columns devoted to it. And it's funny because I've worked very hard to write a book and write a series of related articles that are not terribly divisive, that say, you know, if this is your family, it's okay. That's all I'm doing is saying, it's okay. And yet that feels like it is me throwing down a gauntlet in the mommy wars. But, and it's hard to avoid that, apparently.
Sure. Well, and the mommy wars always has this sort of competitive undertone, it seems to me, which I think makes it so troublesome.
And I think it's a major distraction from the conversations that I believe we need to be having about policy in this country, about how to actually manage the conflict between work and parenthood. And instead of, you know, demanding better law, instead of demanding more support, we're just going at each other's throats on the blogosphere, and that makes me crazy.
Let me get Deborah from, looks like, Springtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Deborah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
My name is Deborah Orban, and I had one child by choice after taking a course in college many years ago on human ecology, and I read the book Population Bomb and decided that it was kind of my responsibility to limit my family.
Well, that's an interesting comment. And Lauren was talking earlier about the, you know, before we got to the Industrial Revolution, families needed a lot of children to help support it. This is very different today.
It is very different. And I do, one of the reasons that I am so puzzled by the onus being on parents to have more children instead of fewer really is the environmental question. I have a chapter of my book about this. And it's tough because, you know, in The Population Bomb, author Paul Ehrlich basically said, you know, we are doomed people unless we curb our reproduction. And he made some very particular predictions that did not come true. Therefore, that whole topic became really demonized. Yeah. The environmental movement dumped it basically as a major issue. And frankly, it's much easier to get people involved around light bulbs and cloth bags at a supermarket because those are small feel-good acts instead of talking about something that, frankly, smacks of eugenics and things that could not be proved. However, now we have a lot of data about global warming and about population. And the feeling today is that the issue isn't so much our numbers worldwide, but our numbers in areas like the United States, where we use the resources that we do. So my daughter, who's 5, will, even being raised in a somewhat green household, will consume 10 times what a child in Africa will consume. Just, you know, we're sitting in an air-conditioned studio now. I will probably get on a plane at some point in the next several weeks. I might eat a burger tonight. You know, these are all things that are part of of how we live as Americans. And this becomes the bigger issue, is that we are making more Americans than our planet can contain. We're making more urban Europeans. We're making more urban South Americans. Certainly in Asia, this is a major issue. And instead of saying, okay, the easiest way to curb those damages against the environment, the easiest way for a child to reduce their carbon footprint is frankly not to be born. That's something that I think makes people feel very uncomfortable, and so we've avoided it as a topic. But we're all watching the weather change this year and last year, and I think it's really hard to not talk about this anymore.
But was that part of your consideration, thinking about the effect of more humans on the planet?
I must say, doing research on the topic scared the hell out of me. That said, it's unusual to hear someone who gives that explanation, and I have a tendency to be suspicious of it. Not that I doubt what our caller said, but I do believe that children can be a totally irrational desire. It's something that we choose with our heart and less with our minds. And if the environment gets deep into your heart, perhaps that's a choice that you make. But it does seem to me to be often a choice that people will make if they've already made a choice with their heart. And then they say, okay, this is something that it benefits, and this is why I can feel extra good about this choice.
Deborah, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Bonnie from Cinnamons. Do I have that right? Yes, Bonnie from Cinnaminson has to say. Bonnie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
You're very
as
welcome.
Always, Marty. It's a great show. Lauren, I have a question for you. I have a 28-year-old daughter, an only child, and her whole life, whenever she meets another only child, she just goes to a special place, and she has always, as soon as she does meet them, she has to tell me, Mom, I met this person today, and they're an only child. And it's something I just can't, I don't really understand, because I'm one of three children, and it just takes her somewhere that is really special to her. So I just thought, as an only child yourself, Lauren, I wondered if you shared this same type of experience meeting other only children.
The only child club, perhaps.
Yeah,
Bonnie.
I think that I do. I don't think I quite articulate it like that, but I have always had very close friends who are only children, and they have always been very, very special relationships. I think we do tend to find each other and nurture those bonds in a really special way, because we know that what they're worth. And I think that, you know, even though we're a growing number in America, we're still a minority. And the experience of growing up in a way that other people don't, not having something that other people do, this sort of puts us in a separate place. And to be able to connect with other people from that place is always special.
Bonnie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Now, is your husband, does he have siblings?
He does. He is the younger sister, who I'm also very close to.
It's interesting thinking about how marriage has changed, and certainly children can be and have been a part of marriage. But as the passage that you read, that there is a different view of marriage, maybe less about duty, more about what do I want out of this. This isn't true for everybody, but that's what I got from your reading.
That's certainly true. Pew actually did a report a couple of years ago on changing feelings about marriage, and the biggest change that they measured is that marriage used to be about parental duty. The purpose of marriage was to have and raise children. Now, that's barely even on the charts in terms of what we think about when we think about lifetime partnership. And that really is a radical change.
I was also thinking about China's one-child policy, very different, because this is the state telling people what they can or can't do when it comes to procreation.
Yes. I'm so glad that you raised China. I did quite a bit of reporting there. And one thing which really hasn't gotten out into the news is there have been a number of studies done in China that show that if people had the choice, they would still choose to have one kid.
Oh, that's interesting.
When they're surveyed, they initially say, no, we would have two. And then it's okay, but if you're still living in the apartment that you're living in, you have the workload and the salary and all these different considerations, would you still have two? And they say, no, then we would only have one. And what these studies have shown is that in one generation, it has become normative. In one generation, families have realized this is actually a good solution to dealing with the pressures of modern life. And so if they could just eliminate this human rights crisis of a policy, this draconian law, I do think that many people would continue to curb their numbers by choice.
You think that might be true in, or perhaps it is true, you mentioned in the UK, half of all families have one child.
Yes, this is from a census report from last month, and I was stunned by the numbers. Half of the UK, one-third of Ireland. I think that people are realizing that to experience the joy of parenting and to maintain a life that feels manageable and to also have a little bit of fun and freedom, it does seem to be a good option. I mean, in the sort of having it all conversation we've been having for a while now, it always amazes me that this is not discussed, because it does seem to be a quick route towards something that we're all yearning for on an individual level. I mean, I do think that we need to talk about the structural barriers that we all deal with, but as long as those structural barriers are in place, our individual choices are increasingly important. And this is how I think I might be able to rectify that for myself.
So being fruitful and multiplying, does that no longer fit today's world?
Well, that's very interesting, because people who are more religious tend to have more kids. And this is true throughout all religions all over the world. This is also the reason that our fertility rate continues to be, you know, while it's lower, as high as it is in the States, is we have a high religious affiliation for the developed world. And those people tend to have more kids. They also tend to have church communities that give them the structural support that the state doesn't. And so, you know, it's interesting, in more sort of liberal and secular areas, we look like Europe. And then in areas where people are more churched, we have a very different population with very different family sizes. And I do believe that that is part of why we're not having a conversation about how to make structural change.
Almost out of time, but I know there are worries, demographic worries going into the future. You've got all these baby boomers retiring, and you don't have enough population to, you know, support their Social Security and Medicare and take care of future generations. I don't know whether, you know, that's an issue that you struggle with or you think about.
It is certainly a concern. I would say that because of only children's high intelligence and achievement motivation and confidence in the data, we do tend to be innovators. And I do think that it is a problem that we can all help to solve. I see it as a temporary issue.
Something else for you to do.
Exactly. Right? You know, the demographic doomsayers out there basically think that this will be the end of America if we have so few children. And I don't buy that.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Lauren Sandler, for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks. I loved it.
I loved it as well. And she's a journalist. She's written other books and is the author of a new one called One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. For more information about the show, go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Check us out on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, email archives, podcasts, satellite radio as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for those phone calls.